Summer's here, and pools all over the country are getting crowded. Australia has 1,300 public pools that clock up hundreds of millions of visits every year. Their chlorine waters have produced generations of young swimmers and swags of Olympic medals. But all is not well with our pools. Many are now over 50 years old. According to Royal Life Saving Australia, hundreds of them face closure in the next decade unless money can be found to carry out major repairs. It's a prospect being studied by Dr. Elizabeth Taylor, senior lecturer in the Department of Architecture at Monash University. She also heads the volunteers who run Elmore Pool near Bendigo in Victoria. Liz, welcome to Late Night Live.
Hi, David. Thanks for having me.
Hey, where did you learn to swim?
I learned to swim in a few different pools in central Victoria. One would be the Castlemaine Pool, which my grandfather actually constructed, and I was always thinking about it in those terms. And the other one was in Ballarat at the Eureka Stockade swimming pool.
Oh dear, that is a...
doesn't have the best connotations.
These days it has an ugly ring of George Pell about it, but we will put that entirely
that
to
part
one
aside.
Side.
Yep.
When were the pools built in Australia?
Well,
and
I think
why?
And why? Okay, so we've got a few phases of public pool construction, but I think it's useful to go back to the 19th century. And before that time, really most people couldn't swim. And that's true around the world today. Most people, over 55% of adults in the world today, can't swim. So it's not kind of universal that people swim. But late 19th century in Australia, as in a few other countries, there's this sudden interest in swimming for kind of health reasons, for leisure, for kind of public morality. And there was a push to construct the first kind of swimming pools. And the first ones were gender segregated because at that time they hadn't invented swimming costumes really. So men mainly swam in the nude. So there was a kind of transition period where you had men's baths and ladies' baths. But by the kind of 1910s, 1920s, you saw hundreds of these early swimming pools being constructed. In somewhere like Victoria, there were about 300 of those. It was also a push for education, I should say. So swimming for life skills so that you would be able to save yourself and save others. But they were usually at that stage more like lakes. So in Bendigo, for example, the main baths were just a really enormous lake, about three times the size of an Olympic pool today.
They weren't for racing. They were for just swimming.
Yeah. Just fun. A lot of diving as well was going on, and recreation. They were kind of places people would just hang out, and they're often in gardens as well. And they weren't chlorinated. It was just fresh or / muddy water. You also had, of course, in New South Wales, the pools along the ocean being constructed as a kind of enclosure from the sea. There was a lot of involvement of unemployment relief, so they were built as work for the Dole projects effectively. But most towns and suburbs had to have a pool to teach swimming because it was compulsory at that time. So these were really widespread, but what you see after the Second World War, and I'm thinking particularly about a Victoria here, there was a push to upgrade those kinds of, you know, swimming holes or lakes into Olympic standard pools for racing, because there was the 1956 Olympic Games in Melbourne. There was an aspiration towards, you know, swimming champions, and there was also a new interest in concrete and chlorine and filtration. So again, you had, it was pretty widespread, but about 200 just in Victoria of these Olympic-style pools were constructed in those decades following the Second World War. And it was really just kind of a standard thing you had in all towns, suburbs, was to build these kind of symbols of modernity. They were always blue. They had a lot of concrete. They smelt. People have this intense nostalgia. You were saying before, the nostalgia for the pool is that icy pole, hot concrete, blue chlorine,
yes,
that kind of thing. Yeah.
Yes.
So that's when most of them were built. And of course, some of them went on to be kind of upgraded and progressively expanded in a way. Like the kinds of pools that are getting built now are very different. They tend to be indoors. They have all these other things added on, gyms and cafes and things like that. And the price tag now is pushing like $100 million is some of the latest ones. So they're really serious new infrastructure now, but we also have this legacy of the older Olympic style pools, which many of them were actually funded and built by volunteers. So there might have been war memorials or they had pledges and things. So they had a real community.
They weren't necessarily councils that were building
them. Yeah, There were some that were. So the inner city baths tended to be very much municipal projects, like, say, the Fitzroy Pool or the North Melbourne Baths, which I've studied as well. But in suburbs and regional areas, usually what would happen is you could apply for a grant from the state government, but they would just match your funding. So you had to come up with about two-thirds of the funding yourself. And it would be things like beauty competitions, so really retro stuff like that, or fishing competitions, and people just donating. And I think that really fed into the sense that these were community assets as well, which made it harder when they started to close. And that's that kind of legacy that I'm studying. Pools like, say, Tugen near Castlemaine, that was built by volunteer labour, mostly donated materials and money with a grant from the state government to supplement that. But it was a sense that it was a community pool. But in the 1990s, like a lot of these volunteer-built and often volunteer-run swimming pools in regional Victoria, they got kind of handed over or taken on by local governments because the compliance issues were becoming more difficult and it was becoming more professionalised industry. And that's when you started to see also pools being closed. And then that kind of compounded it. So people built them or donated them, if not themselves, then their parents or their grandparents. But then they become recast, I suppose, as just too expensive, too hard to keep going.
Is one of the other things that people have cars these days, and there's a notion that you can drive to the coast.
Definitely, yeah, and that's often given as a explanation to what's changed about the relationship to the pool. So local pools were, you know, the way they were understood in the immediate post-war era, and people walked to them, children walked to them themselves. And when you had cars, there was both an ability to drive elsewhere, even somewhere like Eastern Beach, I was reading about the other day, which is in central Geelong. That kind of went into a decline in the 1960s with cars and increased travel. And that kind of also informs how new swimming pools are planned. They tend to be planned as aquatic centres to service a fairly large area that people will drive to. But what I found through the research is there is still that role of the swimming pool as a part of a local community and a local, I guess, amenity. And that's really difficult to reconcile. So even though people increasingly drive, and that does reshape children's lives and teenagers' lives as well, people that fight to either save a pool from closure or to run it as a volunteer pool, they often cite the fact that they can walk there or the children can walk or ride their bike to the pool as being the main reason they like it that way. But that is sort of not necessarily cost effective if you're thinking about it.
No.
as a centralized planner, but that's what people often remember and still value. And it's one of the few places where children, and maybe talking more about teenagers, where they are allowed to go on their own nowadays. So it does have that value there as a destination.
You mentioned before, and this is coming as a shock to me, that you suggested before that learning to swim is no longer compulsory.
It does vary by state. But, yeah, across Australia, it's not compulsory. And there's certainly, even in Victoria, several decades where it wasn't compulsory. And what we're seeing as well is across Australia, the number of children that meet the benchmark for being able to swim, which is set by Royal Life Saving, it's to be able to swim a lap of a pool, basically, to swim 50 metres. About half of children aren't meeting that at the end of primary school now. And those swimming skills deteriorate further in adolescents and teenagers. And some recent research came out emphasising that for people that are becoming teenagers now or young adults, they not only had poor swimming skills to begin with, they had the COVID period where there's often even a greater reduction in attendance at swimming classes and an ability to swim at public pools, for example. And they're unable to swim even that kind of basic metric, let alone being confident swimmers. And then they're going out into the beach or to our inland waterways without those skills. So yes, we have a kind of deterioration in the ability of children to swim, and we also don't have a consistent approach to swimming education. And sometimes that's because schools, they just can't manage the time pressures of having to access a pool that's quite a distance away.
Are we swimming less as a nation?
Well, I think the serious and sad point to make first is that we're drowning more. So the drowning rate is going up year on year, over 350 this past year. And that's sort of turned around years of bringing the drowning rate down, which is one of the main reasons why swimming and swimming pools, swimming education became so common, was to try and have that safety skill. So that's one point. We're still exposed to the dangers of water, but we're no longer routinely swimming. And another thing to emphasize is just the inequity of it. So for many people, they have their own pool, they have a pool at their private school and a public pool, and they live next to the beach. They're not seeing a decline in swimming skills. It's really driven by increasingly wealth and where you live. And in parts of Melbourne, for example, our growing western suburbs, you have very few aquatic facilities, and you also have a lot of migration from countries without a strong swimming culture. And so it's partly driven by that kind of hollowing out of the local infrastructure, changes in the way people's time is planned. So children often have to be driven to lessons now, and they're increasingly further away and they cost money, that kind of stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And you have inequities in location, and then you've got migration. So we've always had migration, obviously, in Australia. It's a colonial migrant country, but swimming education used to be part of that process, and now it does seem to have become disconnected, and some of the highest drowning rates are for migrants to Australia from places like India and Bangladesh, where there isn't a strong swimming culture. But then you're getting people coming here and really obviously want to visit our beautiful beaches and things, and they don't have the skills there. So I guess the answer is some of us aren't able to swim and not being given the opportunities, and that inequity is driving our drowning rate as well.
On ABC Radio National, this is Late Night Live. I'm David Marr, and I'm talking to Liz Taylor, Senior Lecturer in Urban Planning and Design at Monash University, about Australia's pools. Liz, how do you save a pool that's facing closure?
Well, good question, David. I've spoken to about 30 people who have gotten involved in Save Our Pool campaigns since the 1990s. I think first thing to note is that people really do value pools, and you see that community value come out often when you're faced with losing something. Maybe there's something ironic there about you only notice it when it's going. But genuinely, people do value them as community places. And when they come up for closure, and that has happened increasingly since the 1990s in Victoria, as these post-war pools, first of all, that they are not necessarily maintained, and they might have a kind of life cycle, 50 years or so, but it's also about how they're understood. And with council amalgamations, for example, that started to really super drive this idea that those older pools were no longer fit for purpose and were uneconomical and so on. So beginning with, say, Fitzroy Pool, North Melbourne Pool, and a few other urban pools in the 1990s, basically you have to put up a huge fight. And unlike Fitzroy Pool, which is the famous one, because it had celebrities involved, and it only took a few weeks to, you know, they had a protest, they filled the pool, the decision got turned around. Most of the people I've spoken to who advocated to keep older local pools going, they spent years of their life fighting for it. So it's really a colossal amount of volunteer advocacy that goes into sort of making submissions, turning up to protests, and you might not even make it. So it's definitely a long run game. We also have in Victoria, as I am as well, a legacy of pools that are still run by volunteers. So we do, to take the case of Elmore, we do get a lot of assistance now from the City of Greater Bendigo in some of the finances, but essentially the day-to-day management is done by volunteers and has been for about 60, 70 years. And there's a few of those still going. And that kind of relationship just runs on kind of, you know, hard yakka, basically. It's just turning up and mowing the lawns and scrubbing stuff off the pool.
What fails in a pool after 50 years that requires such expensive repair?
Varies a bit by pools and how they were constructed. Often it's a leak, where it's actually not necessarily well understood where the leak is. But it's probably more typical that it's understood as end of life. So you might need, for example, a new filtration system. They don't necessarily meet the contemporary standards. There's also sort of compliance questions around disability access and the design of the pool and so on, all of which are important upgrades to a pool. But when they're sort of put on a 50-year-old pool, what happens is a calculation where the cost to make that pool compliant with the current standards would be, you know, more than the council is willing to pay. So that's often. But the short answer is often leaks. But some of these pools, like the Elmore Pool and a lot of the other post-war pools, they were built by volunteers with like 2 foot thick concrete. So it actually takes a long time for them to leak. It's more this understanding that they're no longer fit for purpose, I think. And there is often a disjuncture. I found that with Teuton, for example, and some other pools where the way a council is, you know, required to think about pools is a much more actuarial assessment of what it might cost to fix it. That value proposition is understood differently by volunteers who then are willing to, you know, you can reline a pool and get another 20 years of life out of it. So it's often kind of subjective what the lifespan is.
It can be really expensive. I mean, North Sydney is looking at a bill of 100. Sorry. Don't laugh. That is so cruel. The Victorian laughter.
That was mirthful laughter. Sorry.
Yes. $122 million they're looking at the moment. Whoa. Yes.
You know what I think it is, David, is actually that is the perfect example for it. The cost of maintaining, so fixing a few leaks, upgrading the bathrooms, putting in a wet deck, that kind of stuff, that's more day-to-day. You know, it's money, but it's not $100 million. What often happens is that you have an older pool and the understanding is, we don't want to just kind of maintain it or sort of fix it up a bit. We need to make it, you know, state of the art. We need to add on an indoor pool. We need to add on
a gym,
all this kind of stuff. Because that's the understanding is that you can't just have a pool. You have to have all the other stuff added on. And that's where you get initially it was $50 million. Now it's $100 million. And we've had ones in Victoria, the Q baths, which were, you know, sort of more just a regular pool, I guess, and then that became an indoor pool. And then a few years ago, it was demolished to make way for an even, you know, bigger, better state-of-the-art pool. It was so big, the roof collapsed. And now that has a bill of about $100 million. So part of my research is maybe pushing back on those, you know, really trophy projects. Maybe it should just be okay to have the North Sydney pool, which was beautiful to begin with, right? Just
yes.
keep it going and invest in that sort of regular maintenance and required accessibility upgrades without necessarily adding on the $100 million. Because that then, in the case of a lot of the older pools in Victoria, when they build one of these mega centres or Disneyland pools or whatever we call them, which are wonderful in some ways, but the price tag means that the council will then say, well, now we have to close all the other pools because this is where our priorities lie. So that's and also those more expensive pools, you know, it's not like they have a longer lifespan. They actually have a longer sort of higher maintenance costs as well. So things like heating and the roof structure and so on, you're more likely to see a kind of structural failure in 20 years after that. So,
what about just digging a lake?
Yeah, I'd like to see that.
You know, just putting a river through it and, you know, bit of mud, I know, and you know, probably a bit of disease, but you know, you could have.
You're not the only one that's asked that. I think we've got a bit of a, you know, a split. There's people, and I'm one of them, that are into kind of swimming in all sorts of places. So you've got wild swimming and enthusiasts of people swimming in lakes and rivers and so on, and that's really seen a return to popularity, particularly since our waterways are a lot cleaner than they were in the 1960s and 70s when people really abandoned that kind of swimming, and that's also been reshaping a lot of cities in Europe where they're putting in swimming pools on the river. And when I say
swimming in the Seine.
Yeah, that kind of thing. So that has seen a return, but then you've also got a lot of people who are, you know, very uncomfortable with the idea of swimming at all. And that, you know, so I guess it'd be nice to see a mix of all these kinds of pools. And say Penrith Lakes in Sydney, I think, is a great example of how you can fit in that kind of a return to the pre-Olympic style of pool again, because that's a pretty low-cost infrastructure. It's free. It's just fresh water, and it hasn't cost hundreds of millions of dollars. It's also got an equity basis to it. It's in the west of Sydney where there's not as many opportunities. So I think in some cases it's probably worth revisiting some of those natural swimming pool models because they don't require as much maintenance, and it won't be for everyone, but it also appeals to that kind of, you know, the popularity of wild swimming, as I mentioned, for some.
Liz, thanks for joining us on Late Night Live.
Thanks so much, David.
I've been talking to Dr. Elizabeth Taylor, Senior Lecturer in Urban Planning and Design at Monash University, about the culture and the fate of public pools. This is Late Night Live.